something wonderfully magical is in the air, isn't it? Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. It's the contagious power of hope.
Finally, a contagion I don't mind catching. That's nice.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's right.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
That's okay.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
I'm not scared.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and other fine affiliates in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, West Virginia, regular old Virginia, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Not to mention a whole bunch of podcast sites and internet streaming outlets blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com, with a lot of show to get to. We've got a couple of guests standing by for our roundtable conversation today on the first two, at least in my opinion, kind of extraordinary. Certainly rollicking and Desi Doyen's stunningly hopeful nights of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Yeah, it's been very lively, very entertaining. I am actually enjoying it. It's fun.
Democrats are coming back together, of course, to back the Kamala Harris-Tim Walz ticket just weeks after President Biden decided to drop out of the race and endorse his vice president for the top of the ticket. But before we get there today, it was also primary election day for congressional and some local legislative seats in three states on Tuesday this week, in Alaska, Wyoming, and Florida, where there were, frankly, few, if any, surprises in the actual results, even if I am noticing that a lot of incumbent Republicans in the Wyoming State House are being turfed out by fellow Republicans. I'm not entirely sure why or what that is about. I hope to look into it as time allows. But for now, in most of the states, incumbents either won their primary contest or they ran uncontested on Tuesday. There were, however, a few problems reported for voters on Tuesday. Three different rural precincts in Alaska reportedly never opened for voters.
Oh.
As state election officials were reportedly unable to reach the poll workers that the state had hired to open and run those polling places. Apparently, this has happened before. A number of others opened several hours late. But there was another issue I just want to sort of flag for now in the great state of Florida, where perhaps the most noteworthy election result on Tuesday night, I think, is that, as expected, former Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Mucarcel Powell easily won her Democratic primary for U.S. Senate to challenge Florida's Republican Senator Rick Scott this November. But there was one issue of note regarding election administration that we still don't seem to know much about, but because of some history that, frankly, none of the local media outlets covering this seem to be noting yet in their brief reports. I just kind of want to flag for you for now, for today, even as more information will be needed before we get too worried about it, I think. But as WPTV reports, several county election supervisors' websites in Florida were not accessible to the public on Tuesday evenings after polls closed for the primary in Florida. In Florida, election supervisors oversee county elections. In other places around the country, they may be called, you know, county clerks or registers or registrars or recorders, etc. But a Scripps News Florida Capital reporter reportedly heard from local officials who said that this was a statewide issue about the inability to reach election supervisor websites to check for results After the close of polls on Tuesday, other election supervisors in the state reported no problems with their website. WPTV interviewed Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections Wendy Sartori Link, who said the issue stemmed from a vendor by the name of VR Systems, used by counties throughout the state to set up their election night results reporting websites. So the supervisor in Palm Beach County said on Tuesday evening that the company, VR Systems, was trying to determine what the problem was. The Florida Secretary of State's office and a public information officer told WPTV that they were unaware of the issue when the outlet called, but later Florida Secretary of State Cord Byrd said that this was not an issue with the Florida Department of State or state resources, and also said that it was a vendor issue. So it was not a state issue. It was a county issue related to this vendor, VR Systems. Byrd from the Secretary of State would not speculate on whether this was some kind of cyber attack issue or just high traffic that overwhelmed servers. Byrd said it was an issue with some of the county's public-facing websites. It had nothing to do with the data or the votes being transmitted to the Department of State. But I'm flagging this because VR Systems, a Tallahassee-based software company, as described by WPTV, a Tallahassee-based software company that hosts supervisor of elections websites across Florida and in other states, was reportedly compromised to some extent some years ago by what was believed to be a Russian spear phishing attack or an attempted hack back in the during the 2016 election, if you may recall that. We do. I do.
Oh, yeah.
It was never made clear just how far into the systems that the bad guys had gotten here, but the Treasure Coast newspapers reported that VR Systems informed St. Lucie County, Florida Supervisor Gertrude Walker around 6:20 p.m. Eastern Time that the company was experiencing issues. In a follow-up email, VR Systems told her that, quote, several counties have reported websites being intermittently slow. VR Systems said it would investigate the cause of the issues and provide updates when possible. Now, as far as I can tell today, the supervisor websites reported as having problems on Tuesday do seem to be back up and running fine. But because of that connection to VR Systems and the belated, if still partial, information about an intrusion of some sort by Russia into at least some of their systems back in 2016, I just kind of want to stick a pin in that item for now moving forward.
Yeah, they better figure out that issue quick.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's just heavy traffic or something.
But they need to get it figured out.
They
got to
figure it out
November.
Anyway. Yeah, because if there's a primary and they're having these problems, imagine what's going to happen in November.
With a massive turnout.
But I should underscore that, you know, these are reporting websites. They merely report election night data, and they don't actually have any actual effect on the actual numbers of how people voted and how they're being tallied by the systems. But a problem on these public-facing sites can, anyway, wreak havoc on election night for a whole bunch of reasons. So for now, since I've got a couple of guests standing by and a lot to get to today, I just want to note what happened here for now, for the record, since it's not getting much coverage, even in Florida, much less nationally. We will, of course, keep our eyes out for further developments in the days ahead, but now you know. The Democratic National Convention, meanwhile, its second night showcased a double dose, as AP, I think, accurately describes it, of Obama firepower to validate Vice President Kamala Harris and deliver an unsparing indictment of Republican Donald Trump. The convention also served up a raucous roll call of states that was essentially one big dance party and featured a charming appearance by the nation's first ever second gentleman, Doug Emhoff, who hopes to become the nation's first ever first gentleman, as he discussed his life with Kamala Harris. There was, as with day one, a lot of memorable stuff throughout the evening on day two. But of course, when you got Obama's on the bill, whether one or in this case two of them, it's kind of tough to keep them from sucking up much of the oxygen in the room because that's just how good they both are at this. Just to give you a flavor before we get to our guest today, here's a moment or two from each of them, beginning with Michelle Obama, whose moving remarks sang the praises of Kamala Harris and, yep, even went low enough at times to take a dig or two at the disgraced former Republican president who is somehow running yet again.
My girl, Kamala Harris, is more than ready for this moment. She is one of the most qualified people ever to seek the office of the presidency. She understands that most of us will never be afforded the grace of failing forward. We will never benefit from the affirmative action of generational wealth. If we bankrupt a business or choke in a crisis, we don't get a second, third, or fourth chance. If things don't go our way, we don't have the luxury of whining or cheating others to get further ahead. No. We don't get to change the rules so we always win. If we see a mountain in front of us, we don't expect there to be an escalator waiting to take us to the top. To work. In America, we do something. Now, unfortunately, we know what comes next. We know folks are going to do everything they can to distort her truth. My husband and I sadly know a little something about this. For years, Donald Trump did everything in his power to try to make people fear us. See, his limited, narrow view of the world made him feel threatened by the existence of two hardworking, highly educated, successful people who happen to be black. I want to know, who's going to tell him that the job he's currently seeking might just be one of those black jobs?
Yeah, she killed so much so that even one of the greatest orators of our day, her husband, former President Barack Obama, was, in my opinion, not even able to outshine her. Though, as ever, he was pretty damn good himself, making a very clever allusion at one point. If you blinked, you might not have noticed it because it was a subtle physical gesture. A, let's say, small but unmistakable reference to Donald Trump's manhood as a part of his remarks at the United Center on Tuesday night.
Here's a 78-year-old billionaire who has not stopped whining about his problems since he rode down his golden escalator 9 years ago. It has been a constant stream of gripes and grievances that's actually been getting worse now that he's afraid of losing to Kamala. There's the childish nicknames, the crazy conspiracy theories, this weird obsession with crowd sizes. It just goes on and on and on. The other day I heard someone compare Trump to the neighbor who keeps running his leaf blower outside your window every minute of every day. Now, from a neighbor, that's exhausting. From a president, it's just dangerous. The truth is, Donald Trump sees power as nothing more than it means to his ends. He wants the middle class to pay the price for another huge tax cut that would mostly help him and his rich friends. He killed a bipartisan immigration deal written in part by one of the most conservative Republicans in Congress that would have helped secure our southern border, because he thought trying to actually solve the problem would hurt his campaign. He doesn't. Do not boo. Vote. He doesn't seem to care if more women lose their reproductive freedom, since it won't affect his life. And most of all, Donald Trump wants us to think that this country is hopelessly divided between us and them, between the real Americans, who of course support him, and the outsiders who don't. And he wants you to think that you'll be richer and safer if you will just give him the power to put those other people back in their place. It is one of the oldest tricks in politics from a guy whose act has, let's face it, gotten pretty stale. We do not need four more years of bluster and bumbling and chaos. We have seen that movie before, and we all know that the sequel is usually worse. America's ready for a new chapter. America's ready for a better story. We are ready for a President Kamala Harris.
There was a lot of that all night on day two of the Democratic National Convention. Let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with some thoughts on all of this history in the making with our friends Digby and Driftglass. That's straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Tell me something good.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I have not yet seen the ratings from night two of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, but night one reportedly reached some 20 million viewers at the very least, at least via television. Streaming numbers are not included in that number, which was several million more than Donald Trump's Republican convention drew on its first night about 1 month ago in Milwaukee. And since it is Donald Trump that is obsessed with ratings and his crowd size, it must have driven him over the edge when that packed to the rafters crowd, even at the United Center in Chicago, broke away for another surprise appearance from Kamala Harris at a completely different venue. A completely different packed to the rafters NBA arena, this one about 90 miles away in Milwaukee, which happened to be the very same arena where Republicans held their national convention about 4 weeks ago. In other words, Kamala Harris and her running mate, Tim Walz, were able to fill up not one, but two packed arenas at the same time, one in Chicago and one in the great battleground state of Wisconsin. Here was two-term Minnesota governor turned vice presidential nominee Tim Walz, who is set to be the headline speaker on Wednesday night in Chicago, speaking to that crowd in Milwaukee on Tuesday.
You know, it was only a month ago that the Republican Party gathered there for their convention right here on this very spot. It doesn't sound like any of you watched it, but in case you didn't, after promising us a speech that was going to be about unity and promising that he was a changed man, Donald Trump subjected us to 92 minutes of ranting and raving insanity. Now look, they left here riding high. They were feeling good. This thing was over. Well, trust me, Milwaukee, a hell of a lot can change in 4 weeks. You run a campaign based on fear like them, you're going to run into a little trouble when you run into a campaign that's based on joy. These guys are focused on the past, like the 1850s past. This campaign's focused on your future.
Well, don't get too excited yet, just yet, Tim Walz, because, yeah, a hell of a lot can change in 4 weeks, and there's still at least 8 weeks left until Election Day. But finally, if there was any lingering doubts about the enthusiasm gaps between at least the two different conventions, the Republican one a month ago and the Democratic one, well, the Democrats absolutely off-the-hook roll call of delegates on Tuesday night may have put that question to bed. Here's what it sounded like, in case you forgot, during the official roll call of delegates nominating Donald Trump as the Republican nominee 4 weeks ago when they called on the great state of Georgia.
Delegates and alternates, let us commence with the roll, with a call of the roll of the states. Georgia. Yeah. 59 delegates.
Not bad. But here's what it sounded like when Georgia rang in for the Democratic roll call on Tuesday, nominating Kamala Harris in Chicago.
Georgia, how do you cast your votes?
Yeah! Ladies and gentlemen, we are here tonight to officially nominate Kamala Harris for president. 5 July, another round of shots. DHC, turn out for what? Turn out for what?
So yeah, that went on for a while, and there were another 50-plus states and U.S. territories along not dissimilar lines for Democrats on Tuesday night in Chicago. But convention enthusiasm and crowd size, well, that's all well and good, but does it necessarily translate into victory? And not just victory at the top of the ticket, but for Democrats in both the House and the Senate and at the state and local level. Joining us now for some insight on all of the above and probably more are our old friends and fellow longtime old school bloggers, Heather Digby Parton, award-winning columnist at Salon and proprietor of the long-running Hullabaloo blog, and the man mostly known as just Driftglass, but sometimes Bill, of the long-running eponymous blog, Driftglass Blog, and his weekly professional left podcast brought to you with his wife, Blue Gal, each and every week from what they describe as flyover country, Illinois, which just happens to be, well, just a few hundred miles away, I think, from the festivities in Chicago this week. Welcome, guys. Delighted to have both of you back.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
So I can't even believe that as we go to air, we're only about halfway through the 4 nights of this year's Democratic National Convention with a seemingly countless list of Democratic superstars, both longtime and up and coming, having addressed the convention already, which a similarly long list, apparently, still to come, amazingly. But before we dive into a few of the specific details, let me start by getting some top-line thoughts first from both of you guys. Heather Digby Parton, your impressions of the Democratic Love Fest so far in Chicago at the halfway mark. As you note today at Salon, Democrats are running up the gender gap there?
Absolutely. I think it has far surpassed my expectations. Let's just put it that way. I mean, when you consider what they had to do, which was completely revamp the thing just in the last month, because the whole, you know, everything changed. And for them to be able to then sort of pivot to this, which I think is pretty subtle, but yet really meaningful to a lot of us, is this idea that we're, you know, confronting this historic, potential historic presidency with Kamala Harris being the first woman and the first woman of color in South Asian heritage. And the sort of bittersweet aspect of that when we consider what happened in 2016 and how it was kind of, you know, stolen out from under us. I don't mean that literally, but it just felt that way. The upset in 2016 and, you know, sort of having this be this kind of, you know, unusually upbeat, joyful, happy, enthusiastic experience. I have to say, I'm a little, you know, nonplussed here. I didn't expect it, and I have to say, I'm truly enjoying it, which I don't normally say about political conventions. Yeah, I have to say,
I did not plan on enjoying it either, and it's ended up. I mean, I'm running on fumes at this point, having slept very few hours, trying to watch as much of it as I can, because I keep planning to, you know, sort of scroll through it to get the important parts, and then I get stuck on, oh, I don't know, an hour and a half of that crazy roll call that was just infectious. but you're right, bringing this together in just 4 weeks' time, as a guy who produced a lot of big live productions for many years, it's very impressive that they have done this so quickly. Driftglass, for all the worries about, oh no, it's another convention in Chicago amid a controversial war after the incumbent Democratic president has decided to not run for another term. Will this be a 1968 disaster all over again? Well, it looks like your home state is actually doing the Democratic Party and the nation proud from where I sit, Mr. Driftglass.
Yeah, well, people forget that there was a convention here in 1996, too, that went off just fine.
Yep.
It was mostly the media drooling for 1968 and cops cracking heads and people throwing, you know, protesters through plate glass windows at Michigan Avenue. And what they got was a few thousand people way far away acting kind of goofy and unserious. And there's no story there. So, oh no, what are we going to do? We'll have to go back to the convention and see this murderer's row of eloquent speakers. And the logistics of this is tricky enough, but to hit every note you have to hit, to talk to every audience you have to talk to, with your very best people, is astonishing. And they did it. I don't know if you saw this, but I did dial over to PBS. And I saw Jonathan Capehart crying on the air. I mean, he was in tears. He couldn't talk right away because Michelle Obama's speech had touched him personally so deeply that he couldn't talk for a minute. And that kind of reaction is nothing I expected from a political convention.
It's kind of true, and I wasn't sure how to actually bring this up, but, you know, Digby, I know you're not my psychologist, and
thank God for you. You
may not be able to answer this question. Thank God for you, but you may not be able to answer this, but I'm going to try my luck here anyway and ask it. Why, over the past two nights of watching this DNC, have I occasionally started weeping? I don't know, every 20 or 30 minutes or so over stuff that does not seem to be all that sad at all, you know, throughout Doug, at various points in Doug Emhoff's speech, for example. What is going on? And certainly during Michelle Obama's, what is going on here?
I've had the same experience. And, you know, part of it on night one, I think it was obvious there was this passing of the torch business, which I wrote about in Salon. Not so much with Joe Biden, which we were expecting. I mean, we all knew there was going to be a big love fest and this was going to be his big, you know, swan song and legacy speech and what have you. But I didn't expect it to come from Hillary Clinton. And it felt to me as though she was passing the torch as well, that this was the end of it for her. You know, she's had a long run, and I was sort of touched, and they interviewed some women in the audience. I guess as it was happening, and they were all crying because of the, you know, the fact that here we have this woman who by all accounts really should have been giving her final speech at the end of her 8-year term. And that, and, you know, So that was kind of touching to me. And then by the same token, the young people have been making me kind of teary too. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I sort of got a lump in my throat looking at the future there and seeing, wow, you know, something's really happening, and feeling that through the whole thing with Harris as well, that, you know, this is a new way, you know, as she puts, you know, they're moving forward. And so there's just, to me, there's just this feeling that something's happening in the Democratic Party that I don't know. I mean, Bill Kristol, of all people, wrote a thing sometime this week about how the Democratic Party is showing the country what a healthy political party looks like. Mm. And I thought to myself, I've never thought that before in my life, that the Democratic Party was a healthy political party, but it is. And it seems to have somehow kind of brought together generationally, you know, all the different factions, racially, ethnically, you know, all the diversity of the party. And everybody just seems to be rubbing along quite well together. Now, I realize, you know, you mentioned the protesters, and that's a real thing, and I don't mean to discount that, but it, just considering the kind of, look back at the 2016 convention, for instance, and the bad blood that was there between the Bernie Sanders people and the Clinton people, and the ugliness that was sort of going on and had been going on for some years in the party, it just seems to have dissipated, and it feels like a party that is, you know, working together toward a common goal. Wow, what a concept. Huh?
And by the way, I'm glad to know it's not just me.
No, it's not you at all. I mean, I think part of what is going on is because hope is a moving thing for the human heart. Mm. It is moving to see Democrats articulate these common values, I think, that we all hold, no matter what your political party is, your political stripe, you know, the values of family, of patriotism, of opportunity and equality for all. I mean, we've all been through a collective trauma over the last 9 years.
Right.
Maybe not for, you know, the MAGA crowd. They think it's fantastic. But for the vast majority of Americans, I believe this has been a traumatic time. And seeing this kind of hope is like therapy.
Driftglass, there is on the other side of the coin sort of this unavoidable contrast of Democrats highlighting throughout the week, you know, past winning and losing presidents and presidential candidates and vice presidents and first ladies, from the, you know, both Clintons to both Obamas to obviously Joe Biden, even Jesse Jackson in a wheelchair at one point on day one. That, by way of contrast to this long list of winning and losing presidential and vice presidential candidates and first ladies who did not even show up at the RNC a few weeks ago, much less have a speaking slot there, you know, from George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan. The list goes on. Even Donald Trump's own vice president, who, like the others, has refused to support Trump's 2024 run. That would seem to indicate the opposite of what Desi and Heather are talking about, but indicate a dying political party, or maybe more generously, a completely transformed one. But if that party loses yet again this year, what happens next?
If Republicans lose, or Democrats?
Yeah, if Republicans lose.
Well, we've seen it before. They tend to go in the hole for 3 days, and they rebrand themselves, and they come out, and they swear they were never there. And what are you talking about? I never liked George Bush. I never talked about deficits. And they usually have a couple of billionaires backing them, and they have a whole bunch of people in the media who would like to forget their own complicity. And they just sort of bulldoze the whole thing down the memory hole. I mean, that's where the Obama administration went. And that's their weakness, because they have no past to draw on. Mm. What I saw in the convention the last couple of days was like an enormous version of that that carousel ad from Mad Men. This reservoir of nostalgia and joy. And remember when we were this? Remember these guys? Remember these people? These are all of our people. These are amazing people. And a history that goes way back. No Republican dares to look back past Donald Trump. So they have no past. They have nothing to draw on other than rage and ignorance and paranoia. And so once that is taken away from them, they'll go to ground. I'm sure there'll be people who are currently our allies who have an idea about rebuilding the Republican Party out of those deeply warped materials that we left behind by Donald Trump. But they're in a lot of trouble. There will be something else coming out of that, and I don't know what it would be, but mostly they'll be in a state of shock and denial and possibly a great deal of violence. You know, once their illusion is snapped, they're not going to like the people who snapped it. And the person who will be leading the charge will be the loser.
Well, of course, we're getting way ahead of ourselves. My fault there, because it you know, watching that, it really does make me wonder how this party can continue if they don't win this election. It seems like the stakes are just that high for them as well on this little sort of, you know, fantastical fantasy world they have built for themselves. I think, Drifty, when you were here, I think when you were here last on the show a few weeks ago, we were discussing Tim Walz's addition to the ticket. You had quipped something like, where have the Democrats been hiding him or some such, but the roster of talent on display this week by the Democratic Party, you know, so many seemingly up-and-comers, it really does both demonstrate what a, you know, deep bench of talent that the party now seems to have, and begs the question as to why America does not know more about some of these people. We sure know plenty about a whole bunch of, you know, losers and cretins in the GOP, but we don't seem to know the very positive, smart, talented people that comprise the Democratic Party these days. Why is that? Whose fault is that? Democrats? Media? Something else?
You remember when Kamala Harris got off her plane, walked over to the media scrum and said, "What you got?" Right?
Mm-hmm.
And what do? They asked her questions about Donald Trump. What about Donald Trump this and Donald Trump that and Donald Trump said this? That is the filter. That is the lens through which way too many people understand the news. People who pay no attention to politics or very little. And there's no way to squeeze a Tim Walz through that lens, or the entire Midwest, frankly, or most of the Democratic Party. The media has a story they want to tell. And the story they want to tell is Democrats in disarray and protesters and cops in the streets. And we are denying them that story. And that's what's freaking them out, because this is not the fairy tale they've been telling people for 40 years, which is that both sides are bad, both sides are terrible, there's no difference between the two parties. Mm. And only when there's a breach, a radical opening in that box, can people peek through the media filter and see the actual Democratic Party that I know, that you know, that I'm sure Digby knows and Desi knows.
Well, one of the, you hit on a point, you know, this is one of the things I've been saying for so many years to so many people. We hear when they call in to the show, oh, both sides are bad, both sides are corrupt, which has always seemed to me to be the laziest point of view possible. You may not like both sides. There may be different things to dislike about both sides, but they are not the same. They are decidedly different. And it feels like we're seeing that difference before our eyes, at least for those people who are paying attention. Digby, is Tim Walz going to make it through this week? Because every time I have seen him on camera, on Monday night, for example, day one, he's either so earnest, clearly pondering the historical momentousness of this moment and his place in it, or he's on the verge of tears from what it all means. Did you notice that? Is that just me?
I have. And last night or on the night two, he was he was in Milwaukee, and he came out first and introduced Harris, and it was just incredible. I mean, he was so filled with energy, so excited, and in a crowd. I don't know if he'd ever been in a crowd like that before.
Yeah.
Which was like 15,000 people. He's alone in the center stage. You know, it was like in the round there in the arena.
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking around and you can just see the kind of wonder on his face. I find it just incredibly charming. And I really find it, you know, endearing and hopeful that somebody like that is being put, you know, thrust into this position. Mm-hmm. I really think that's a great thing for someone who's not been, I mean, he's had experience in Washington. It's not like he's not somebody who doesn't know how things work, mm-hmm. or hasn't been around politics. He has. He's governor of a big state. He's a
congressman for 12 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did. He did his time there, and he knows how things work. It's not that. It's just that he seems to be very, very normal. and this is something that, you know, in the weird campaign on the other side, it just feels such a relief. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he just seems like such a relief of a normal human being. And any normal human being in his position who Well, you know, he was operating as a governor. It wasn't like he was out of politics. They just plucked him off the street. But to suddenly be in this very amazing political moment, thrust right into the middle of it, and just sort of, he seems to be enjoying himself and feeling it, you know, thoroughly. And as you say, you know, noting the momentousness of what's going on in his own mind and going, wow, look where I am. I think that's just great. I think it's really great for the ticket too, because Kamala's a whole different kind of politician. You know, she's polished, she's professional, she's very, and she has to be as a woman. She has got to be someone who it looks to be very much in control and very much, you know, with, while at the same time being accessible and smiling, et cetera, et cetera. But she has to have a real persona that speaks to authority. And he doesn't have to do that. And he isn't doing that. And it's a really nice combination, I think.
Yeah. And I think in both cases, in different ways, they have both, at least so far, stepped up to meet the moment, to meet this historical, you know, extraordinary, in some ways unprecedented,
sure,
moment.
Like,
yeah. Digby, they, Newsweek and some others have reported, and I do think there is something to this, that they say all the attention on the top of the ticket for Democrats has meant down ballot races are getting largely ignored at the party gathering in Chicago, which they note could spell trouble for Democrats who face a difficult map to expand or hold their control of the U.S. Senate and to retake control of the House. Is that a concern?
I you know what? I honestly doubt it. I really don't think that people who are watching this are watching anything but this big presidential race under these circumstances. You know, Harris coming in unexpectedly and Biden dropping out, and it's this big debut and there's all this momentum. I think that if there's anything, she and Waltz will have coattails that will probably help people down ballot. Certainly, I have to say, watching Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and Hakeem Jeffries being interviewed over the first 2 days of the convention, they sure seem to have a little spring in their step, I have to say. Now, I don't know whether or not that's just a vibe or whether or not they're getting polling results, but I did read a thing about Sherrod Brown, one of the very, you know, the
threatened
Senate candidates, who was very threatened in Ohio. And he's always sort of risen above it somehow. He's popular in the state and he's done okay, but they were really worried about him. And most of the polls in the state say that this ticket is going to do nothing but help him. And the reason is this, because it's going to get out the Democratic vote in big numbers where they need them to get out in order to overcome whatever kind of lead Trump might offer Brown's opponent.
Yeah.
So the professionals seem to think that that's going to bringing out the Democratic base, which is what Harris and Walz seem to be doing, is only going to be helpful for the down ballot. That's what I'm hearing.
Driftglass, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. No, Kamala Harris, Michelle Obama, who gave an extraordinary speech, probably the best one of the night. That speech was beautiful and uplifting, but it came with very strict instructions that you got to get out there and get to work and do something. And that is what I think the core of the party is going to leave this convention with. Like, how many phone calls can I make? How many postcards can I write? How many doors can I knock? Because this is really important. The people I respect and adore and believe in tell me I got to get off my butt and go do something. And so I think this will supercharge the volunteers, especially the young volunteers, who really are, they've known in their life Barack Obama and Donald Trump as their president, and they're horrified by the fact that Donald Trump might be coming back. And these are people like my stepdaughters who are now in college, who are very politically active and who like their reproductive rights and really believe in civil rights and really believe in LGBT rights. And there's just this whole wave of strength coming off of this thing that's specifically focused on getting your butts in gear and getting out there and knock doors and phone bank. I think that's going to have a lot of downstream effect on other tickets, because if you're going in to the place to vote for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, you're going to pull the lever for the rest of the Democrats, more than likely, especially if you're a new voter.
One really hopes that that is the case because, as you know, you guys have mentioned before, you know, that you have to have a big enough voter turnout to overcome any voter suppression before and during election day, during voting. So I think that that is the key message that hopefully the Democrats will continue to get out about the need for a big, huge, I mean, historic voter turnout.
The, Driftglass, I think there's a sort of a related question, and I think a fair question about whether events like this, you know, if they're geared too much only for the party faithful, or if they move the needle for, you know, Mr. and Mrs. America, this average Americans. There was a short montage on Tuesday of Donald Trump supporters who realize, who say they realize their mistake, and they're now planning to vote for Kamala Harris. I think one of those montages was put together by broadcast guest, Rich Loges, a friend of ours.
Of Leaving MAGA.
Of Leaving MAGA. But there was this appearance, which I don't know how much attention it actually got, but it seemed kind of extraordinary to me. Donald Trump's own former White House press secretary, who was herself rarely seen during her term of service, she actually showed up in person to speak at the Democratic National Convention.
Behind closed doors, Trump mocks his supporters. He calls them basement dwellers. On a hospital visit one time when people were dying in the ICU, he was mad that the cameras were not watching him. He has no empathy, no morals, and no fidelity to the truth. He used to tell me, "It doesn't matter what you say, Stephanie. Say it enough and people will believe you." But it does matter. What you says matter. And what you don't say matters. When I was press secretary, I got skewered for never holding a White House briefing. It's because, unlike my boss, I never wanted to stand at that podium and lie. Now here I am, behind a podium, advocating for a Democrat. And that's because I love my country more than my party. Kamala Harris tells the truth. She respects the American people, and she has my vote.
Donald Trump's former press secretary, Driftglass, I don't really have a question here other than to say, wow.
Yeah. This event is meant to be fractal. You can break it up into 30-second bits and 1-minute bites and 2-minute bites and 5-minute ads for every kind of audience. So Stephanie Grisham is a great person to flood the zone in undecided voters or those Obama/Trump voters, et cetera. There's something for everyone. There's a whole bunch of labor stuff out there. You want to get your union members out? That's there too. And the idea that it's all being presented in 4 days sort of misses the point that it's designed to be broken up in pieces and reused and recycled over and over and over again, given the fact that apparently in the last 3 weeks, the Harris-Walz campaign has hauled in a buttload of cash.
Yeah.
So they're going to have money to do that sort of thing, too.
Half a billion. Digby does that. I mean, obviously, you know, when I see something like that, I'm like, oh, my God, Donald Trump's own press secretary. But does that move people who might actually consider voting for Donald Trump, or who are voting for Donald, who are serious MAGA folks? Do they look at that and say, hey, wait a minute, something here has gone tremendously sideways?
I think it might. I mean, there are groups of people, these sort of, as Driftglass just said, you know, the Obama-Trump voters. I mean, there are these people, this kind of mushy sort of group of independents and swing voters who've been kind of flowing back and forth during this cycle. And, you know, when Biden was in, these people, you know, they called some of them double haters, you know, you remember. This is the kind of message I think that, I don't know how many it brings over, but I think it's meaningful. I mean, it's what we were talking about at the very beginning, and Driftglass said this, that this is about showing absolutely every single constituency in the party, showing every single one, and it's massive, and it even includes Republicans. That's how big the Democratic Party tent has become. And that's what they're trying to say is, look, we're all doing this. I mean, you've got your left, you've got Ocasio-Cortez comes on. Everybody knows that she's sort of the avatar of the left. Mm-hmm. I mean, not really, but they, you know, that's her reputation. Mm-hmm. The crowds, you know, it was soaring, you know, excitement for her. Hillary Clinton comes on right afterwards, the same thing. This kid, this, you know, this just goes on. Every single person who comes up there with this different thing fractally, you know, it creates a viral moment, which is part of what they're planning here. They're very sophisticated this way. They know what they're doing in the digital world. And they are, you know, they're just trying to show America, look, you know, everybody's welcome here. Come on. You know, I mean, unless you're a Trump cultist,
yeah,
you've got a spot in the Democratic Party.
I think that all of us have here have been on this beat for at least 20 years. I don't know. I've certainly never seen a Democratic Party notorious for its, you know, squabbling more unified than it is now. Digby Marcus Molitsis, the creator of the liberal and very Democratic Party-centric Daily Kos website, writes today, and you wrote something very similar at Salon, I noticed. Kos writes, quote, it was telling that mere weeks after Democratic Socialists of America disowned Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she took the stage on Monday as a full-fledged representative of the American Democratic Party, the mainstream of that party, without ever having compromised a single tenet of her ideals. He writes, the party has moved to where she was all along. The last two laggards in the Senate, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, will be gone next year. Has Kos got it right? Has the party truly moved to the progressive left at this point?
Well, I would say this. I think it has definitely moved. There are two reasons for it. The first is Donald Trump has changed everything. It made it focused every faction of the Democratic Party on the threat that was coming from the right. For the first time, people kind of all everybody woke up and went, whoa, we can't do this. You know, no fight, no infighting. Let's just get to work here and try and do the best we can under these circumstances and fight back. And that was the resistance. And that started right after Donald Trump was elected in 2016. And it encompassed much of the left and the progressive institutions. And everybody was on board with that. But it was also, let's give some credit to Joe Biden here, because what he did when he came in, no one expected him to be as you know, just openly progressive as he was, mm-hmm. and working as hard as he did, yep. to push through progressive legislation, to speak in progressive terms, to, you know, the pointing the, you know, Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
You know, doing the kinds of things that progressives had been asking for and yearning for a long time without alienating the rest of the party. He brought many people along there. And let's also then finally, I'll just say this. I think progressives have grown up. I think they have started, you know, yes, we have factions that are still, you know, out there causing trouble, and there probably will be again. But for the moment, when I look at leaders like Ocasio-Cortez or Pranila Jayapal, or, you know, any number of other, the young ones like Maxwell Frost from Florida, mm-hmm. these are people who are serious politicians, and they do not give up their ideals, but they do understand that they need to work the levers of power, and they're doing it, and they're doing it very effectively. So I think it's been the mainstream of the party moving left, and I also think it's the left side of the party wising up, and between and all under the threat of this, you know, frankly, fascist movement that Donald Trump has created out of the Republican Party, which happily went along with it. I think that's why we're seeing this. And it's great, because I think if they can maintain power and get back in, that they can, you know, they're now in a position to get some really, really important stuff done.
It seems to me that it's a big chunk of this is the cowardly Democratic Party coming around to realize that, oh, these ideas that are so popular are not so crazy leftist. They're actually popular. They actually represent, if you will, the middle of the country. It's, you know, why we use Stuck in the Middle with You. A lot of people used to say, oh, you're all in the middle. That's our theme song, because I believe, no, I'm not some crazy far leftist. I think I'm right there in the mainstream. And now it seems like the Democratic Party is starting to figure that out as well, whether the media does or not. I don't know. Driftglass, thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the base of the party finally is getting heard. And the base of the party is pretty progressive. Mm-hmm. And again, this weird filter that everything Democratic had to flow through. The people who spoke for us in the media were, you know, Maureen Dowd, claiming that, you know, what the Democrats need is an open convention, mm-hmm. a glorious open convention. And the base said, hell no, that is not what we need. Shut up. There are all these spokespeople out there who have been claiming the mantle of we are the avatars of the liberal media, who have nothing to do with the Democratic Party, nothing to do with the progressive base. And it seems like the progressive base, almost as one, has reached out and told them to shut the hell up.
Yeah.
That the party is actually us. And it's a weirdly similar thing that happened on the right, which is the crazy fascist lunatic base said, no, 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 we don't want Jeb Bush. We want Donald Trump.
Yeah.
That's our guy.
Yeah.
That's who we are. And we look at Kamala Harris and Tim Walz and say, no, that's who we are. That's what we want. We want labor, and we want Pramila Jayapal.
Yeah.
And we want Nikki Baczynski, my congresswoman, who is very agricultural based and reasonable center kind of thing. The whole thing is who we are. And the base finally got its way, and that's a good thing.
Well, and yeah, it's interesting because, you know, for years, you know, Rush Limbaugh was saying to Republicans, we don't need Democrats light. And progressives have been saying to the Democrats, we don't need Republican light. Well, go ahead. Let's have a real contest between what Republicans really want and what Democrats really want. And let's see where America falls on that spectrum. And that may be what we see over the next couple of months. We will find out. Guys, always a delight speaking with both of you. Heather Digby Parton can be found at salon.com all the time and digbysblog.net even more so. More than 100% of the time. You can also find her at on the Twitters at Digby56, and you can find Driftglass on the Twitters at Mr_Electrico for some reason. His blog is driftglass.blogspot.com, and his pro-left podcast can be downloaded for free, I believe, at proleftpod.com. Thanks, guys. Delight as ever speaking with both of you. I know there's some debates coming up, so we'll probably be shouting at you in the near future.
Oh, yeah.
Whether you like it or
thanks
not.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Okay, thanks as well to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at brandblog.com. That is made possible by those of you who hit one of those donate buttons or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Thank you in advance. We really need your support right now. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Stay hopeful, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.